Welcome to Worldview from WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonald. Donald Trump says the U.S. must seek an outcome worthy of the sacrifices made. We'll consider what's next in America's longest war. We all know women face situations of profound vulnerability and often display incredible resilience. A new work of fiction brings us stories of female survival. I'll talk with the author of a book of short stories called Girl World. Don't forget, you can join the conversation on Twitter at WBEZ Worldview. Last night, President Trump said the U.S. was going to win in Afghanistan, a war he once derided as a complete waste. Let's talk about the address last night and where U.S. policy is headed with Andrew Bacevich. He's a military historian. He's author most recently of America's War for the Greater Middle East. And his piece about last night's speech in the Los Angeles Times is The Conflict in Afghanistan is Trump's War Now. Thanks for joining us, Andrew Bacevich.
Glad to be with you.
It sounds like the thing that was persuasive to Donald Trump about Afghanistan was that a hasty withdrawal would lead to a flourishing of terrorist organizations in Afghanistan, similar to what's happened in Iraq, and he doesn't want to see that happen. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I mean, it's a plausible scenario, and one can understand why he and his advisors would want to avoid that outcome. That said, there's an assumption embedded in that scenario, maybe two assumptions. The one assumption is that Afghans are utterly unable to manage their own affairs, so that were it not for the presence and guidance and support of the United States, they would all just fall on one another and chaos would result. The second assumption is that other countries in the region would stand by and allow that to happen doing nothing. And I think both of those assumptions deserve to be questioned.
Now, the Afghans being unable to do it themselves, it sounds like, you know, if you look at the Afghan military or the Afghan Air Force, these are not really working and are going to take a long, long time to make work. They're taking heavy casualties. They have heavy attrition rates. Is that a pretty solid assumption that the Afghans are unable to do this by themselves?
Yes. In other words, if we see the problem as a military problem, then it is probably true, despite the decade and a half of our efforts and that of our allies to build competent Afghan security forces, even today, they probably can't handle the adversary. But perhaps the problem is not a military problem. Perhaps it's a political problem. Perhaps the solution to this problem is not so much defeating the Taliban or ISIS and other entities, but rather coming to some settlement of differences that will not transform Afghanistan into a functioning liberal democracy, as perhaps people in the George W. Bush administration once imagined, but it could at least restore some amount of order and stability. So when I try to emphasize the point that perhaps the Afghans can manage things on their own, it's really in the realm of politics that I'm referring to, not so much in the realm of conducting this never-ending war.
Now, the issue about other countries helping Afghanistan out, helping the Afghan government out, it seems like this would a lot of times involve India, which is, seems interested in not seeing the Afghan government fail. Do you end up getting a proxy war with Pakistan? And I mean, if we don't already have one in Afghanistan, obviously China's got some interests there. There's a lot of players.
There are a lot of players, and it is not possible to exclude that possibility. It's also possible to argue that countries like India and Pakistan don't wish to have a war between themselves begin as a result of Afghanistan, that they themselves, and yes, throw China into the mix and Russia into the mix and Iran into the mix, that the people running those governments may conclude that it is in their mutual interest to try to avoid Afghanistan becoming what it did become in the aftermath of the Soviet withdrawal back at the end of the Cold War. And I'm not trying to suggest that any of this is a sure thing, that there's no risk involved, but I would argue strongly that we've been attempting for the last decade and a half to fix the problem by through the commitment of American and Western hard power. And after over 15 years, it hasn't worked. And so perhaps it's time to try something different. That was Trump's own view when he was a candidate, and it seemed to be his view until last night when he made a 180-degree turn.
And one of the things he did last night was a good hearty scolding of Pakistan, which U.S. leaders have been doing for, it seems like, the whole 16 years of involvement there.
Yes.
What do we do with that?
Jerome, I don't know. I mean, that has to be the honest answer. Step number one, I think, would be to give up the fiction that Pakistan is an ally of the United States. It's not. Pakistani interests, particularly the interests of the Pakistani military, are very much at odds with ours, and I think it's time to recognize that. That doesn't mean we want to somehow add Pakistan to the ever-growing American enemies list, reminding ourselves that Pakistan, of course, is a nuclear power, but they're not an ally. They're much closer to being an adversary.
And Pakistanis mentioned that they suffer many more casualties from terrorism than the U.S. does. Even their armed forces are,
Yes. You
know, fighting and dying against terrorists all the time, and they might want to see a solution to something like this, too. But the solution cannot be a proxy state for India, in their mind.
Right. It's very difficult, I think, for us to get inside the mindset, in particular, of the Pakistani officer corps, which is obsessed, as far as I can tell, with the notion that India poses an existential threat to the existence of Pakistan as a nation state. And that then leads them to behave in ways that, from our viewpoint, are utterly reckless and self-destructive. So one might say, well, the answer is we need to persuade them to see the world the way we do rather than the way they see the world. And, of course, that's very easy for us to say and very difficult to do. But to some degree, the solution, if there's a solution, lies in persuading Pakistan, and I focus here in particular on the National Security Establishment, to revise its assessment of India and to come to a different understanding of what the security and the well-being of Pakistan and its people actually require. Because the posture that they have asserted is, again, from the point of view of outsiders, really counterproductive.
I'm talking with Andrew Bacevich, a military historian, and we're discussing President Trump's speech last night on Afghanistan. You know, it's interesting to look at this from a U.S. political standpoint. We just had a president in Barack Obama who did a timeline, who talked about big troop commitments and overwhelming force and using counterterrorism. And now we have a president who is not talking about troop levels when he talks about Afghanistan. He doesn't talk about timelines. He talks barely about benchmarks that seem pretty amorphous. What did you make of that aspect of what he was trying to say to the U.S. about our commitment in Afghanistan?
Well, it was a terrible speech. And if the purpose of the speech was to persuade the public and persuade the rest of the world that the United States actually has a strategy in Afghanistan, I think the speech has to rate as a failure. As you were just suggesting, the absence of specificity was in some respects the most prominent part of the speech. He announced that he's got a three-point plan, and he ticked off 3 points. But I think the day after, it's impossible, really, for us to know what the substantive implications of those 3 points is likely to be. And, of course, the issue of how many more troops, one could argue that that's really not the main question, whether it's 4,000 troops or 6,000 or 10,000. But nonetheless, the refusal or the reluctance of the president to provide some numbers is suggestive to me of either the absence of any real conclusion on his part and those of his advisors, or they're basically going to try to conceal from the public what is now about to occur. Not that they'll be able to, because sooner or later we'll find out how many more troops are going there and what they're doing.
Do you think U.S. voters really care about the war in Afghanistan at this point? It's
no.
Just a constant, you know, you can rain down an avalanche of platitudes on people, and
right.
and it just keeps going.
First of all, the American public has not cared about Afghanistan for years now. And secondly, the political moment is one that does not even permit any kind of serious sustained attention. You know, if you and I had had this conversation 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, we would not be talking about Afghanistan. We would have been talking about the possibility of war over North Korea. If you and I had had this conversation last week, we would have been talking about neo-Nazis and violence in Charlottesville and the resurgence of racism. But we're having a conversation this week, and now it's Afghanistan. And if you and I talk next week, I firmly believe it's going to be something else again. So there's no sustained attention. The political conversation or the national conversation, to the extent that there is one, basically responds to whatever Trump has tweeted in the last 24 hours. So we're being jerked here and there. And I think the absence of sustained attention is a real problem as we jump from one story to the next.
It's interesting that candidate Trump came in as a non-interventionist, somebody who didn't want, you know, Iraq wars or Afghanistan wars. And that was kind of novel on the Republican side of the presidential ledger. And people seem to find that attractive, but maybe nobody really thought he could do anything about it anyway.
I probably disagree with you a little bit. He portrayed himself as an anti-interventionist. Those were the words that came out of his mouth. That was supposedly one of the implications of grabbing hold of this label, America First. But I've come to believe that Trump is a man who adheres to no principles whatsoever. And therefore, we ought to have taken his anti-interventionist stance with an utter grain of salt. Similarly, he gives a speech last night, lays out a strategy, we're going to win the war in Afghanistan, lots of strong rhetoric, victory, kill. And were one to assume that he meant what he said, that somehow behind those words there were principles, that would be one thing. But I think that the rhetoric we heard last night actually has no more meaning than his rhetoric during the campaign. We have a president who is devoid of principles, who acts on impulse, whose actions are shaped principally by a concern to maintain his own self-esteem rather than to actually solve problems.
All right. So for Afghanistan, that just means more of the same, that McMaster will get to decide for a while, and then we putter along.
I think that's exactly right. We putter along. Again, we don't know what the additional escalation of troops is going to be. It's probably going to be a 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000. But given the efforts that we've made in Afghanistan over the last 15 years, up to 100,000 U.S. troops on the ground, various methodologies, you know, counterterrorism, counterinsurgency, building up Afghan forces. You know, we've tried just about everything, every approach. To imagine now that a small additional increment of troops is going to somehow produce a conclusive result, it seems to me, is a fantasy. But the generals who surround Trump have emerged as his principal advisors, all of whom, of course, are veterans of our post-9/11 wars. They may, in some respects, be good people. I'm sure they're patriotic people, but they're utterly unimaginative, and they are incapable of looking beyond "let's keep trying" as a course of action. And for reasons that are difficult to understand, they have persuaded Trump, at least for a period of time, to be in their camp.
I'm talking with Andrew Bacevich about last night's speech by President Trump on Afghanistan. Andrew Bacevich is a military historian. He's author most recently of America's War for the Greater Middle East. I wanted to ask you a question about a piece you had in Tom Dispatch, the website, and You kind of pulled back the lens on this piece and talked about some of the fundamental problems that the U.S. has that Trump is just a symptom of. And, you know, I had a Canadian philosopher on shortly after the election, and he thought that the United States' biggest problem with its position in the world is that it couldn't reform itself. It was hastening its own demise or influence because it absolutely couldn't do something as simple as changing the Electoral College, and that people felt that this was an impossible thing to do, and we just can't do things like stop gerrymandering or, change the electoral system so there's less money in it. Those things are just kind of impossible things to do. But these are the things you talked about doing in this Tom Dispatch thing.
Well, I mean, the gist of the essay was to argue that Trump is not the cause of all of our woes. He's a consequence. As you just said, he's a symptom. A symptom of what? In my view, he is what you get when you allow elites to embrace a series of really bad ideas. And I think that when the Cold War ended, that's what happened. In that utopian moment when supposedly history had ended, to cite the famous essay by Francis Fukuyama, we got suckered. We came to believe that globalization was going to make everybody rich. I'm obviously overstating this. We came to believe that American military power was unstoppable, and therefore we were in a position to order the world. We came to believe that traditional restraints on the definition of freedom, that they could be discarded, and that we could invent and reinvent our own personal identity. And we spent the next 25 years trying to implement, as a nation, trying to implement, to act upon these ideas, and none of them have yielded the promised results. People got rich. A lot of people ended up being left behind. We killed a lot of people in our various and sundry wars in various parts of the world, and yet instead of creating order, we created disorder. Some of your listeners may disagree, but I would argue that although today, as individuals, we enjoy a greater personal freedom, liberty than at any time in our history, nonetheless, our society is deeply ill by any measure. And that enough people by 2016 recognized the failures of post-Cold War policies, that in their desperation, they voted for somebody who is utterly, totally, and completely unqualified to be president, but who nonetheless claimed to have some sympathy and understanding of their plight. So my essay, which suggests we need to do some of the things you mentioned, you know, end gerrymandering, get money out of politics, the burden of the essay is really to say we need to recognize the defects of those notions that are embedded in the trajectory that the country followed for the past quarter century or so, and I see no inclination to do that.
Andrew Bacevich is a military historian. He's author most recently of America's War for the Greater Middle East. He wrote about Donald Trump's speech last night in the Los Angeles Times, and we talked about some of his ideas in a recent Tom Dispatch article on reform in America. Thanks a lot for joining us again, Andrew Bacevich.
Oh, thank you.
This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. It's time for our World History Minute with historian John Schmidt. John's the author of On This Day in Chicago History, but he works a global beat for us. And today, John Schmidt has the tale of thievery, a thievery of great art.
This was August 21st, 1911, the day the Mona Lisa was stolen. Well, Mona Lisa is a portrait of a young woman. It's painted by Leonardo da Vinci in the early 1500s. And after the artist died, the painting was purchased by the King of France, and it eventually became part of the collection at the Louvre in Paris. And at the time we're talking about, to the general public, it was just another painting among many there. Well, in 1911, the Louvre hired some handymen to build protective glass cases around a number of the paintings. And on the morning of August 21st, the museum official is walking through, and he noticed the Mona Lisa wasn't hanging in its usual spot. So he assumed the painting was in a workroom being fitted with that protective glass. But a day went by, and nobody could locate the Mona Lisa. It had been stolen. Well, when the Paris newspapers found about this, they went wild, and each one tried to outdo the other with fantastic stories. And they had theories of who stole the painting, how it was done, whether it'd be recovered. And the foreign papers picked up the story, and suddenly the Mona Lisa was the most famous painting in the world. Now, the French police had no clues. They rounded up everyone in the local art world who seemed suspicious. And among the suspects they picked up, who they arrested and later cleared, was a young Spanish artist living in Paris, and his name was Pablo Picasso. Well, 2 years went by. In 1913, a Florence art dealer received a message from a man claiming to have the Mona Lisa. And a meeting was arranged, and when it turned out the man did have the painting, the Italian police swooped in and they arrested him. And the thief turned out to be a young Italian named Vincenzo Perugia. And he'd been part of that handyman crew that was building protective frames. On the night of the theft, he'd hidden in a closet until after closing time. Then he simply removed the painting from its frame, rolled it up under Spock, and he walked out. Well, at his trial, Perugia said he had not stolen the painting to sell it. No, he just wanted to return the Mona Lisa to Italy, where it belonged. And the judge was impressed with his claim of Italian patriotism, and Perugia got off with 8 months. Well, today you can still visit the Mona Lisa in the Louvre. And if you do that, you notice that there's always at least one armed guard standing right next to it.
The story of the Mona Lisa getting stolen in August of 1911, that's really some kind of story. And only 8 months in jail, it seems like if you did it today, you'd get longer.
Well, you probably couldn't do it today. I mean, I said always at least one guard. First time I was and saw the Mona Lisa, they had one guard. I was there 2 years ago again. Now they had two guards out there. I don't know if that was for some special reason in case the one guy gets knocked out. I don't know. But they actually had two guys standing around the Mona Lisa, two armed guards the last time I was in Paris. So I don't think anybody's going to get away with that thing soon unless they come in with a tank or something.
They usually have to burst through the crowd that's standing there staring at it.
Oh, yeah,
and
anybody who's seen it knows it's a lot smaller than you think. I think it's only about 30 by 21 inches or something like that.
John Schmidt, our World History Minute, the Mona Lisa being stolen on August 21st, 1911. Thanks, John.
Okay.
Coming up after the break, we'll talk about a new short story book called Girl World. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. I don't often get to read fiction. I read lots of nonfiction for the program, but I got to read a series of short stories in a book called Girl World that I really found absorbing. And there were stories of women surviving in some pretty desperate circumstances. And the author is Alex Poppy. She's here with us now. She is an educator, a writer, a lecturer at the American University of Iraq in Sulaymaniyah. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on the program, Jerome.
Tell me something about yourself and how you came to writing, because it seems like you tried other things.
Yeah, my first degree is in marketing economics from Marquette, and then I was an actor for a long time. And one of the last projects I worked on was this short film by a woman named Larissa Kondracki, who ended up writing The Whistleblower with Rachel Weisz and Vanessa Redgrave. So when Larissa was working on that film, she would have me read the script, and it was about trafficking. It was about Kathy Bulkovic, I think that's her name, and she was a UN worker, and she blew the whistle on the UN engagement and involvement with trafficking of girls in Bosnia after the Balkan War. And so I started reading all her source material. She had taken a lot of it from a book called The Natashas by Victor Marlek, and he's a Canadian journalist. And I got really interested in different things, and I was starting not to like acting. And so I wanted to work with an NGO, and I had no transferable skill set. Like, nobody wanted me. So I certified to teach, figuring I would go abroad and gain some international experience and then try to work in the NGO world again. And I've discovered I really like teaching. I'm good at it. I think it plays to my strengths as an actor. And I was able to do a lot of aid work when I was abroad. I got to volunteer with different organizations, so it sort of satisfied that. And I just kept teaching. And then I think writing and storytelling was a natural extension after being an actor. So I took my first writing class in October 2010. I'd come back to the States again, and I signed up at the Writer's Studio New York, which is the best writing program I've ever been involved with. And that's where I learned how to write.
The first story in Girl World is about a woman who is trafficked. And it's from – and most of all the stories are from the woman's point of view, and except one maybe towards the end. And I think we hear about trafficking situations, but we don't hear about them in a first-person way like this. And it really – it brings you in with some harsh realities there.
Thanks. Yeah, I wanted the story to be visceral. So I had read The Buddha in the Attic by Julia Otsutka. I hope I'm not butchering her name too badly. And she uses this first-person we plural narrative to talk about the story of Japanese mail-order brides that came to the United States at the end of the 19th century, and then the Japanese experience as immigrants through the internment camps into present day. And I liked that narrator. Also, the rhythm of the language was almost kind of like a sing-song rhyme, and I needed that rhythm to undercut the horrors of the subject matter. So I used her narrative technique, this first-person we, that was very rhythmic and rhyming. There's a musicality in the language that I consciously crafted to buoy the narrative because the material is so dark. And then I did a lot of research. I, you know, worked off the things that I had read when I was reading Larissa's script, and then did more research. And a lot of that stuff, like the cracks about the UN people who say, oh, I'll buy you, I'll save you, that was from things I found on the internet that are in published reputable sources that anyone could research and find. I don't even think I changed all the names because that was a gross, in my opinion, a gross misjudgment of power, misuse of power and authority when the peacekeepers are there to protect and they become the victimizers. There's something wrong. And that to me is part of thematically what goes through a couple of these stories, that you have people who are entrusted in the care of someone else, like in service in the military, and they are grossly victimized with no sense of justice. And it's not just women. I have a second book that's based on Moxie. I extended Moxie into a novel. I'm currently looking for a publisher for it. But
Moxie's a short story about a woman who was a model who
she loses half of her face. That story came about because I actually had a partner who told me I was losing my looks due to drinking, and I was like, I don't necessarily agree with that. I don't think it's due to drinking. I think it's because I'm older. And this idea that middle-aged women get marginalized, right? Like, you know, especially what is it? What do you do if your whole identity has been based around what you look like? Now, I grew up, I would say, fairly unattractive. I had, you know, braces and headgear and an eye patch and glasses. Thank God, not all at the same time, but at various stages. So I definitely am not someone whose my identity is wrapped up in my appearance. But becoming an actor and being an actor for a long time, you are hyper aware of what you look like, or, you know, sometimes. Some actors are. I was. I'll just speak for myself. And so when that all changes and, you know, you're not young and attractive anymore, like, well, how do people define themselves? So that's why I created this supermodel who loses half of her face. So she's like a yes-no face because one side is perfect and the other side is completely scarred and burned up. And it's her story of, like, what is she going to do and how is she going to go on living when everything that she's ever known about life is suddenly gone and in a very short amount of time.
But the interesting thing to me was when she begins questioning, was I happy before when I was a supermodel? I was having fun, but I don't know if I was happy. Mm-hmm. And that's when, you know, it makes you think, well, she's going to gnaw on this in a way that it will be productive, that she won't She won't spiral out of control.
In the novel, it takes Jax a while. She has to really go down the rabbit hole of destruction before she can sort of start to climb her way out. And the way the book has evolved now, there's a lot more self-destructive behavior that goes on as things slowly change. I'm not a happy ending writer. I think you might have gotten that. But I do like these moments of redemption. I mean, I think life is messy.
I'm talking with Alex Poppy, and we're discussing her short stories in the book Girl World. And they bring a lot of issues to light that I think we take in a news way, and I do on this show all the time, in a way that allows us a lot of distance. And the story about rape in the military, and we hear about rape in the military pretty frequently. There's the last year record number of sexual assaults reported in the military. And you have a young woman in the book who has been sexually assaulted by her superior, and kind of the way you were describing before, somebody she had trusted and put her faith into, and ended up sexually assaulting her, and then she ends up caring for him in a VA facility.
Yeah, that story for me is, I love that story, and I mean, I don't love it because like I wrote it. I love it because I love her fragility, and it didn't come out and plan that way. I use a narrative technique that, oh my God, I forgot his name. He's a totally prolific, well-known writer. He teaches, okay, I forgot, I'm terrible. Anyway, this idea that you are dealing with difficult material, but you reflect it back onto like a zany workplace to have this kind of break from the heaviness of the story. So it's the kind of story, I mean, when I talk about the story, I call it my sad, funny story about rape in the military, because there are things designed to laugh, to make you laugh. And I think that that's okay to laugh. But when, you know, I also unfold her rape little by little in the story. And I think it really, maybe it's only almost at the end of that story when she's like, you know, I doubt Bridget's ever had, you know, like a Colt 45 locked and loaded at the base of her head when someone stronger than she has pulled down her pants or made her cry. It's told in this kind of young language. Because
yeah, it's
she's
kind of
so,
a shorter, kind of poetic way in a burst.
Yeah. And at the same time, those sentences are – I crafted them to be super spindly. They unwind and spool and go on and on and on because her mental – state is pretty shattered. But unfortunately, that issue was getting a lot of press until Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, she had put forth a new legislation to take the adjudication of rape cases in the military out of the chain of command. And it was defeated in 2015. And suddenly people don't talk about it anymore. And some people still report that there are, I know Amy Zering said in 2013 there were something like 49 cases a day, and that 80 to 90% of cases are even unreported. So that 49 a day is probably grossly low. And that 6 out of 10 people who do report suffer retaliation, and the retaliation that the ladies and gentlemen suffer is horrible. They lose their benefits, they're dishonorably discharged, they get accused of like mental imbalance, and all this was researched, and that's where I got a lot of the material. When I decided that I wanted to write this story, I just did a lot of research, different interviews with people, and then fictionalized it.
How much research do you end up doing for a short story? Because I think you really are digging in.
It depends. I mean, I need to know what I'm writing about. For Moxie, it was easier. And that's kind of like a love letter to New York as well. And I lived in New York for a long time. And I used to work for a designer called Momo Falana. So I would see what happened with the models. And, you know, that was not so much researched. Actually, not researched at all. And Ras Al Amud, I lived in the West Bank. And I saw a lot of how hard Palestinian life is in the occupied territories, and I saw a lot of this gross inadequacy and inequality firsthand.
And that story is about a Palestinian woman who her child dies while she after she gives birth. She's having a hard time getting through checkpoints.
Right. That's actually a true story. Sometimes the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, they will just mess with people for the sake of it to show the Palestinians that they are in control. And they wouldn't let a pregnant woman through one of the border control checkpoints. And so this woman went into labor and lost her baby. I don't know how much you're familiar with how things work in Israel, but there are zones and roads that are A, B, and C. Do you know this? Am I
a little bit? Yeah.
Okay, so one is like Palestine is Israeli controlled and only Israelis can use it, and then one is like Israeli controlled but Palestinians can use it, and one is like Palestinian administered and Palestinians can use it. But you can sometimes get stuck driving like 50 kilometers because you can't take a straight shot on a road that's to a destination that's 17 kilometers away if you're Palestinian. And there are different license plates on the cars that facilitate a faster checkpoint. When I worked there, I remember coming through the airport and was worried about getting stamped because I was going to go back to Iraq where I was employed full time. I was doing a summer thing, an education thing, and the West Bank. And it wasn't stamped and it wasn't really an issue. And then someone told me that when you're coming through the Tel Aviv airport, if you're a Westerner, you're not stamped, because if you have that stamp, then you can sometimes go to other places of the occupied territories and they want to control what people can see and what they can't see. So I remember I wanted to go to Ramallah to listen to some speaker, and it was like, oh, if I can get into this kind of a car with this kind of a license plate, then that car won't be checked at the checkpoint and it won't matter that I'm not stamped. And it's like all these things for mobility, which is something we know we take for granted every day. We go where we want to go when we want to go there.
Do you ever think that I would like to write nonfiction about this? You could do journalism about some of the topics you're doing? Although I think the stories are very affecting because they take you to a place journalism doesn't take you, but it's almost like, you could do either one.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I have written some nonfiction, but I don't know the form of journalism. And like I have a couple of students that have had some horrific experiences. They're IDPs that live in the Kurdish region in Sulaymaniyah, and they remember the invasion. And they're, you know, they were like 10, 11, 12, 13, and they remember the invasion. And they have a variety of experiences with coalition forces. And one student credits coalition forces with saving their life. And this kid, by the time he was 21, he had run for his life four times. Another kid remembers the coalition forces coming into heat, and he remembers, because his father spoke English, first during the night raids, the coalition forces would take off their gloves and shake his father's hand, and they were very friendly. And he can remember other times after there was The Humvee was blown up outside of his school, and there was this ultimate crackdown in heat. And I believe that the coalition forces started working with a different Iraqi force, and then the nature of the night searches changed. So, like, the women are in one building, the men are in the courtyard. They're freezing. Humvee's like, he's like this big, he looks like a teddy bear, and you know, like the soldiers hitting him and stuff like that. And I'm always like, how do you not hate Americans? And he was. He's like a philosopher in this teddy bear body. He says, the fault of Iraq is the Iraqi people didn't stand together. And he also has had really good experiences with Americans. So he was part of the ILEP program, which is the Iraqi Young Leadership Exchange Program. And I really worry about the future of these programs under our president administration, who, one, wants to stop immigration from these seven countries that he finally shook Iraq off the list, and two, just his cutting of State Department programs. And this diplomacy is effective. It does change people's minds. So he came to the United States for 6 weeks at this ILEP program, and I think that's really what changed his mind. He, you know, loved it here and had great experiences here and great contact with people here. So then he goes back and he sees the other point of view. So anyway, I've written about those kids, and I mean, I just had some great experiences. Our university is incredibly liberal-minded, and we have a lot of latitude in what we want to teach. And so I was teaching The Handmaid's Tale and The World's Wife, and there was like an honor killing like the second week into my teaching. So you're teaching these incredibly, I don't know, powder keg type literature, and then you have something like that happens. So the university in its own way, in a lot of ways, is opening people's minds and their points of view.
I'm talking with Alex Poppy. She teaches at the University, at the American University in Sulaymaniyah in Kurdistan. And we're talking about her short stories, Girl World. And we'll be back with more after the break. We'll talk a little more about Iraq. Thanks for joining us. And I'm Jerome McDonnell. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell talking with Alex Poppy. She's a writer. Her book is Girl World, and we're talking about her short stories, a couple of which are set in Kurdistan, and you teach at American University in Sulaymaniyah. And what's it like there right now? How is it going with students? We were talking a little before the show, and it sounds like everybody's got a pretty heavy dysfunctional circumstance with governments and getting paid, and it just is quite a circumstance people are facing.
Just to clarify, so Sulaymaniyah, 65% around 65% of the people who live in Sulaymaniyah are government employees, and the government employees have not had their full salaries paid in 2+ years. So every few months they'll get a partial salary, and that's been going on, and it affects all the public school teachers. So the first year that that happened, the public schools, they were teaching like half time, like maybe part of their schedule. And then the second year, the teachers didn't go back to the classrooms for some schools until after December 1st. And there was a question if they call the school year or not. They decided not to. And it's harder because these kids are, you know, missing significant portions of their education. Our university is a private university, the American University of Iraq, Sulaymaniyah. So we have some kids maybe coming from the public school system, but the majority probably not. But it's still hard. Like, people who own property and have land and houses, they have wealth, but they don't necessarily have cash. So it's weird to see that money they're not liquid. And so that affects things. The Kurdish government and the Alabadi government have had disputes about, you know, and so the KRG hasn't received all its payments from the Alabadi government in the south and in Baghdad. And Mansour Barzani's declaration that perhaps the KRG is ready to become a free and independent Kurdistan based on the referendum coming in September is, you know, makes me think, because the international community is committed to a whole integral Iraq. The UN ambassador has said as much at the university. Like, they don't support a Kurdish independence. They want to see Iraq stay.
Let's talk about the referendum here. I'm not sure most people realize there is going to be a referendum next month in Kurdistan, and and people will vote for independence, and that, you know, 99% probably. And then what? It's not a binding referendum, but what do you do with a place that does not want to be a part of Iraq? They're gonna move eventually.
Well, I don't know. There are a lot of players that have a stake. I would say that Turkey does not want to see a free and independent Kurdistan. Syria is a failed state, and Iran probably doesn't want to see a free and independent Kurdistan either. Iraq, the southern Iraq, certainly does not. There's the issue of who gets the oil. You know, what happens to Kirkuk? Whose territory does it fall into? Right now, I believe the Peshmerga control most of the oil in Kirkuk. I could be wrong on that, but I believe that that's true.
But if the Peshmerga did all the fighting of ISIS, do they get something out of that? Should they get more autonomy, to get some kind of independence?
The Peshmerga had help from the coalition forces, which has a lot of the Shi'i militia. So that's a really sticky subject in terms of, you can't just say it was all Peshmerga. It was Iraqi forces, Shi'i militia, coalition forces, and Peshmerga. And then there's also the question of the Peshmerga are not a unified Peshmerga. There's the Barzani Peshmerga and the Talibani Peshmerga. And that really is what the question is about a free and independent Kurdistan. There isn't political unity in Kurdistan because the political parties are, you know, at odds with each other.
There's a family that has fought on both sides of the civil wars in the Kurdistan area.
Right. That was a long time ago. And this is back in history where the Kurds were fighting amongst each other. And one side invited Saddam Hussein to come help them defeat the other and then said, no more, no more. You know, there'll be no more Kurdish blood shed, no more Kurds shed Kurd blood. But the feelings are quite contentious. Where I live is the political opposition stronghold, and they're quite negative. They have quite negative sentiments toward the present government in power. I've lived in both governments. I've taught a lot of the Barzani grandkids at the International School of Chaifat. I really can't say. I know that people resent that he has overstayed his term limits, and they claim that it's, you know, he needs to go. But there's no political unity, so it's hard to see how they would govern themselves effectively when they can't get past what seems to be some sort of petty things from political party to political party. And when I talk about petty things, I'm talking about things that maybe I don't understand what I'm talking about, but this is what it appears to be like. We have to get a residency card when we live there. And in one part of the country, it's one cost. In one part of the country, it's another cost. In my part of the country, it's like 13 times more expensive. And so it's some sort of wonder, is that to keep where I live in the country from attracting foreigners and foreign investment? They're not all playing together well. They're not sharing the sandbox. So it's hard to see how they're going to govern.
Do people there think the U.S. is going to be a positive force in their future, or do they see the U.S. as something that is more history to them now?
I don't think that I can speak for how people feel there. I hear a fair amount of anti-American sentiments from students. And I would say that it's, you know, it's not without its, I can see why they say what they say. And at the same, you know, at the same time, there's always going to be the party line of, oh, he got, you know, the U.S. got rid of Saddam. Yay, we love the U.S. But then underneath it, no. I was really surprised so many students wanted Donald Trump to win. And just asking them why. And then finally they're like, because we know he's going to ruin your country. Like, they really like that idea. And also someone in President Trump's team had said that he supported a free and independent Kurdistan. So those two reasons together. But to hear, like, they really thought that it would be the downfall of America and that's why they supported it. You know, oh, how the mighty have fallen. I don't know what that is.
Alex, what is your next work of fiction here? Are you working on a novel, a novella? What's up?
So the second thing I wrote, I said it was a novel, took Moxie to a novel, and I want to get away from these hard reads. So I'm at the very beginning stages of like a dysfunctional family, like a family that can't communicate, and they use like flamenco, because I love flamenco, I love Sevilla, and I want to use it as an extended metaphor, like a Tracy Letts meets Pedro Almodóvar, and see what happens.
Well, that sounds like fun. I'm glad I read Girl World, and thank you for bringing these stories to light.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Alex Poppy is an educator. She's a writer and lecturer at the American University of Iraq. And her first book of short stories is Girl World, and you can get it out there on Amazon. Thanks a lot for joining us. Nice meeting you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Worldview, we'll be talking about Hong Kong. A court has sentenced three activists to prison for their role in pro-democracy movements there 3 years ago. And there's been lots of protests about their imprisonment. We will check in on the umbrella movement in Hong Kong tomorrow on Worldview. Worldview is produced by Steve Bynum and Julian Haida. Thanks to Jinghong Chen for production assistance. And thanks to Colin Ashmead-Bobbitt for engineering. I'm Jerome McDonnell, and you've been listening to Worldview on WBEZ.